Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Graham Ward, and I'm the head of the School of Arts, Histories and Cultures here at the University of Manchester. I also happen to be a professor of contemporary theology, and for at least for this evening, I'm going to be something of your host. It gives me a tremendous uplift to be on a stage with two such distinguished scholars. And I just want to try and get my little bit in at the moment, which is just to frame the debate and the conversation that we will have this evening. The relationship between religion and literature is as old as recorded time. It was the priests who were the scribes and the chroniclers, and artists, architects, and artificers like Bezalel in the Book of Chronicles served in the temple precincts. The later Jewish tradition opposed the Pythagorean view that the cosmos was composed of numbers. In Kabbalah mysticism, the world is written by the finger of God. Its secrets are inscribed within the alphabet, Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth. To create was to orchestrate, the song creation sings. And we find a similar idea in the opening lines of the Gospel of St. John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made through him. And through the Christian Cappadocian fathers and on into the Orthodox tradition, all human expression was understood to strain to be doxology and participated in a cosmos that moved liturgically down through time. They spoke of theurgia, the labor of the divine, and theopoiesis, the creative operation of God. Even with the Renaissance Neoplatonic thinkers, the Greek word poiesis, from which we get the word poetry, was understood not as representation but presentation, the bringing forth of something into the world. Poesis use a philosophical vocabulary bore an ontological charge. It concerned Genesis. Our very own Sir Philip Sidney, writing in the Elizabethan period, viewed poetry as the very possibility of reversing the loss of paradise. In literature lay the power to create the world anew, the power of redemption. There was a time then when it was almost inconceivable to divorce religion from literature. Not that secular ideas were absent from creative writing in this period of Western history. The love poem from Sappho and Catullus down to Shakespeare in various guises, satirically or extolling the human condition and earthly fragilities. And yet even here in the love poem, it frequently sheared off into the transcendent, even to the edge of doom, as Shakespeare narrates it. But with the dawn of the modern age, when religion retreated into private convictions and pieties, and the public sphere preoccupied itself with politics, economics, and the hard sciences, there was a change that was frequently marked with the signpost secularism. The relationship between religion and literature changed. With the withdrawal of God from the world, with the end of what the sociologists termed the enchanted worldview, with the dominance of techne and instrumental reasoning, literature dwelt with new ideas. Literature dreamed differently. Until perhaps very recently. And this brings us to this evening. Because there are today some sociologists speaking of a new re-enchantment of the world, a re-enchantment that's taking place with the help of science. And it's not simply a post-9/11 phenomenon. From the early 1970s, the Harvard professor of cultural anthropology, Daniel Bell, raised the question of a return of the sacred. And more recently, a word being bandied around by some of the biggest names in social theory and cultural studies is post-secular. And so, for some, this word suggests that we in the West and even indeed in Europe, that icon of secularization, are possibly moving out of a secular age. And all this raises once more the question of the relationship of religion to literature. And it's a timely question because it concerns how we characterize the cultures we now inhabit and the relationships of those cultures to those that preceded them. I can think of fewer thinkers and writers more able to explore the issues around this question than the two men of letters that we have here with us tonight. And both might well lay claim to the title of public intellectual. Professor Amos joined the university in 2006 and is internationally known for his novels, short stories, reviews, and essays. I remember as an undergraduate reading English, becoming feverish with jealousy when I read the Rachel Papers, published in 1973. A masterly and innovative craftsman, Professor Amos's incisive intellect has explored questions about capitalism, religion, science, politics, and literature since that early debut in a series of trailblazing novels and blistering articles. Never backward in coming forward with an opinion, Professor Amos, while perhaps not courting controversy, has certainly created it. George Orwell once wrote that the writing of literature is always a political act, never more so than when politics is in conversation with religion, I would add. And to add further to the volatile mix, we have Professor James Wood. He's the Harvard Professor of Practical Criticism and on the staff of The New Yorker. Essayist, novelist, and journalist of enormous talent, he came to public attention in 1990 when he won the coveted British Press Young Journalist of the Year Award. Author of three books of influential criticism, he too is not averse to controversy. With his depiction in 2000 of the postmodern contemporary novel as hysterical realism. Whether such a description characterizes any of Professor Amos's novels, as it does the work of Thomas Pynchon, Don DeLillo, or Zadie Smith's White Teeth, we may discover. Religion and belief have never been far from Professor Wood's own writing. His first collection of literary criticism, The Broken Estate, Essays in Literature and Belief, appeared in 2000, and his novel, The Book Against God, in 2003. With these two public figures, then, we're all in for quite an intellectual feast. So let me now invite Professor Amos to offer up the first course.
Good evening. Can you all hear me? Thank you all very much for coming. I think we're going to have actually a quiet and cooperative evening, and unless Graham wants some. Because, as Francis Bacon said in about the year 1600, given the melancholy choice between atheism and superstition, the poet would have to go for, the scientist would go for atheism, and the poet would go for superstition. And I think it is a melancholy choice myself. I'm not an atheist. I'm secular to my bones, but I'm not an atheist. And I think atheism is a deeply irrational position and a presumptuous one. It is amazing, the total tonnage of what we don't know about the universe is truly humiliating. It has recently turned out, that the macro world, the world of the very large, is almost as Taoist and weird and convoluted and counterintuitive as the micro world, the subatomic world. For instance, in the real universe, if you go outside and throw your keys in the air, they not only do not return to your hand, they accelerate up into infinity. We have discovered that the universe is not only expanding, but accelerating. And no one has any idea why. Something like some humiliating figure like 98% of the universe consists of dark matter and dark energy, which we are in the pathetic position of having to call, we describe it as dark material. That's all we know about it. So standing as we do about 30 or 40 Albert Einsteins away from even the most rudimentary grasp of the universe, it is not only presumptuous, it is crabbed, it is crimped to describe yourself as an atheist and irrational. On the other hand, when I was growing up and when I came to literature, I thought that here was something. Here was a body of words. Here was a logos. Here was a divine creation that, in my view, has strengths that religion cannot have. And central among these is the problem of death. Religion solves that problem, not to my satisfaction. As Larkin put it, describing religion, I think there's very little more to say. He says, that great musical moth-eaten brocade created to pretend we never die. The problem of death is a vast one, and perhaps that's what literature essentially is a vast rearguard action against this fact of our lives. So the problem of death is solved by religion. The problem of panic, the problem of evil is not solved by religion, and the problem of panic is not solved by religion. By panic, I mean our helplessness, not only in the face of the universe, but in the face of our planet, with inexplicable and violent acts permanently waiting to happen. It's Sylvia Plath called, one of her names for God was King Panic. Brilliant oxymoron where he, serenely presides over this world of panic and tells us that there is an order in it. I never believed that, and I thought that, in fact, literature this turned out to be an illusion too, but literature was more worthy of worship than religion, in that it was something palpable, something divinely bright and beautiful, and it was actually there, and it nonchalantly included within itself all scriptural writing and all writing about the soul and the heart, which is what, of course, literature and religion co-eternally share. One of the great functions of literature has been always to attack religion, of course. Satire probably comes from the Greek siloi, which were pro-scientific attacks on superstition. Ben Jonson skewered the alchemists, Swift the astrologers, and a whole rabble of occultists, spiritualists, and numerologists lie sprawling in the wake of Hudibras. And it's always struck me as a beautiful symmetry that when I look at those video vicars on the American religious right, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the like, what strikes one immediately is that these are Chaucerian figures, that it was all covered in the Canterbury Tales. And here is the summoner, and here is the pardoner, with the same almost delight in their own hypocrisy and venality. But much more often, literature and religion provide a kind of symbiosis, an osmosis. One critic has said, and I think this is close to the truth, that the function of religion within literature is to provide myth and imagery. metaphors, you know, Yeats, Pan and Aguirre, those images that yet fresh images beget, that dolphin torn, that gong-tormented sea. Literature and religion are co-eternal. They go, and myth, they reach very deeply within us. I'd like to round off with three different cases of how writers have used religion and used it in the least cynical sense possible. One is Graham Greene. Now, it seems almost as though Graham Greene adopted Roman Catholicism because it gave him a moral scheme that he could hold up against the world. And that's why his writing often seems schematic, in that you know that once you come across an adulterer, they're going to be either tritely punished or improbably converted, that their fate is sealed. And just to make a personal observation, I interviewed Graham Greene on the occasion of his 80th birthday, and I said in my naive way, this was some time ago, I said, so you're probably more religious now than ever, I said, with the subtext being that, you know, you're going to pop off quite soon and you want all that nicely bedded down for you. And he surprised me and enlightened me by saying that, he said, oh no, he said, my faith has in fact never been weaker than now as I approach death. And it wasn't for the obvious reason. He said, belief is like a talent. It's like a power. It's like your creative powers and your sexual powers and your erotic powers. And it's something that weakens near the end. And faith, he very much included in that triangle. I'd like to say a few words about Milton. Milton wrote the central English poem, or the central poem in English. And according to my favorite critic, the Reverend Northrop Frye, he believed in the story of Adam and Eve so absolutely that there would be no difference in its tangibility to him than the events of his own life. And although it's often said that he was of the devil's party, that as a good Republican, as an opponent of the hereditary principle, he sympathized with Satan, who, if you remember, and it's always struck me as a great central beauty, this idea that there was a war in heaven. When God announced that Christ, his son, would be his heir, nearly half the angels, all nine orders of angels, rose up. Even in heaven, they couldn't stand it another second. Quaffing immortality and joy, walking on the empurpled pavements, lying on these great duvet-like clouds, they couldn't bear it another second. And this is often said to explain why Milton was of the devil's party. But I think in the very end, he was of the human party. And the power of those closing lines of Paradise Lost, so spake our mother Eve, and Adam heard, well pleased, but answered not, for now too nigh the cherubim stood. And then the cherubim would dance and begin to parch that temperate land. And Adam and Eve gather their courage and make their way out of paradise. And I think in little, this is what we all have to do, and this is what the imagery of literature is telling us as well. And I'd like to end with what I think is a great epiphany from George Herbert. he too was a man of faith and a cleric. He wrote a poem called Love, where I think you have the identity of human love and divine love expressed most beautifully and memorably. And I want you all to imagine a human situation, which I hope and trust you've all experienced. It should all happen to us once. where you have felt in the face of the loved one such unworthiness and objection that you almost are on your way out of the door because you feel the radiance and the majesty of the loved one, and you feel your own fallenness in the face of this. And then instead of rejection, what you find is a miraculous acquiescence. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful, ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcel. You reminded me that G.K. Chesterton once said that the reason for the incarnation was that they were so bored by eternity. James.
I grew up in a evangelical background with lots of priests dotted around in far-flung outposts of the family. One of the formative experiences for me as a teenager was seeing my parents go from being fairly ordinary Church of England churchgoers to charismatic spiritualists, Pentecostalists almost. So that one of the tunes that I remember being played a lot in the church in Durham that I went to as a kid was entitled "Your Way, Not My Way, Yahweh." It's quite tuneful, actually. Your way, not my way, Yahweh. I think that was one of the reasons that, as a kind of refuge from a certain command style of belief, and I do credit the evangelical tradition with taking that element of command seriously. I mean, Jesus is essential command or challenge or riddle to Nicodemus. It's all or nothing. It's a revolution of the soul, and you must be born again, or just go away and don't be involved. But don't be lukewarm. The thing that Dostoevsky understood: hot or cold, but not lukewarm. That was certainly my formation, and I think as a refuge from that, I discovered literature and was drawn particularly to the novel as an alternative world, which clearly in some way analogous to religion has to do with belief. We were talking about this before we came on stage. A fiction, it would seem, requests belief from us. It doesn't exactly command belief. And one of the reasons it doesn't exactly command belief is that it has traditionally been aware of its status as a fiction, aware that it's in the business of what Thomas Mann called the game of not quite, that fiction is belief as if. And we can see this, can't we, inscribed in a very early novel like Don Quixote, which is all about questions of belief. And indeed, is quite blasphemous in its comic impulses, it seems to me. After all, Cervantes is quite aware that he's writing about someone who has whose psychological problem is that he reads fictions as if they are scripture. And so that when he has Don Quixote talk to the priest, he knows that that's quite a fraught moment, because the priest, in effect, says, well, now, these romances that you read about, Arthur and Amadis of Gaul and all this sort of stuff, they're fictions, and they're that's quite different, you know, from the kind of texts that we read. The texts that we read about people like Jesus have a different status, and you've got it all wrong. You should transfer your belief away from these fictions to worthier texts. So Cervantes, I think, knows exactly what he's doing, and then, of course, as you know, in the second part of that novel, he plays around a lot self-consciously with the question of what is a fiction by having Don Quixote come back 15 years later only to find that everyone has been reading the novel called Don Quixote, so they run around saying, but you're the guy I've been reading about in that novel. So that's obviously one way in which fiction keeps the question of belief going. And I think is a little different, at least from the command to believe as we traditionally interpret, as we think of religion as traditionally involving. A completely unprovable surmise of mine, as George Steiner would say, much work needs to be done on this. There is much work still to be done, I think he would say, which is a good cop-out. But a surmise of mine is that in some way the doctrinal collapse of formal Christian belief in the mid to late 19th century is in some way bound up with the rise of the novel. And if someone would only give me a fellowship for a few years, I might go away and do enough reading to try and write about this and prove it. But you do have this fascinating concurrence in the mid-19th century, which is, on the one hand, fiction is beginning to be treated by people like Flaubert as a kind of religion, as an art to be worked out monkishly with devotion, as a clear substitute, as the next form of religious devotion. At the same time, as biblical scholars and theologians are beginning to treat the Bible as narratives. People like Strauss, who George Eliot translated. Ernest Renan writes his Life of Jesus. Renan, interestingly, and this is what put me to think about this, is Ernest Renan writes an absolutely a blockbuster in the 19th century, sort of soft biography of Jesus, called The Life of Jesus. Renan also wrote novels, and it was learning that fact that made me think about, in some way, the 19th century novel as being almost a slayer of formal belief. And then that leads me to a third thought, which is that perhaps there is something inherently secular, even blasphemous, about narrative itself. Maybe simply the fact of putting a story in motion, right? Of saying, this happens, then that happens, then that happens, is to start to destabilize doctrine as such. After all, the Bible begins with a story, doesn't it? And it begins with a profoundly unconvincing story where we feel very much the strain of what's having to be explained away. And what's having to be explained away is the source of evil, the origin of evil. And the profoundly, as we all know, the profoundly unconvincing story that has to be told is essentially a way round that. There was a tree, they were forbidden to eat it, someone persuaded someone else, the apple was plucked, the fruit was plucked after the serpent, and so on. It's not surprising, is it, that Milton is attracted to that story and then begins to make of it in some way a kind of powerful argument against doctrinal certainty. Coleridge said about the Book of Job, which would be the other great example of what happens when you make a story about the origin of evil or about the origin of suffering. Coleridge said about that book that it's the one book in the Bible that proves that the Bible was written by human hand and not by God, because surely God would not write such a book against his own powers, against him. Surely God would not write a book which begins with God saying to the devil, let's test old Job, shall we inflict a bit of evil on him? It's the other way around. In fact, Satan says to God, what about testing your powers? And so Job is selected as sport, essentially. For that reason, if one were to take a thread through particularly the novel, I think it would be true of poetry too, and of Western literature, you would find that, and Martin mentioned it, you would find that the problem of evil, theodicy, is absolutely the central theme of narrative. It's what Defoe writes about in Robinson Crusoe. It obsessed George Eliot, as you know, when she talks in Middlemarch about the roar on the other side of silence, this idea that if we could hear the rabbits squealing and the grass growing, we would be so overwhelmed by what Nietzsche says, if we put our ears to the heart chamber of the world and heard the amount of pain in the world, pain and joy, he actually says, to be fair, in the world, we would simply crack from the strain of that. We can't be, as Eliot says, we have to go about being well wadded with stupidity in order to protect ourselves from our exposure to that level of universal suffering. Obviously, it's Dostoevsky's great theme. Melville's too, to some extent. Camus, Graham Greene's In the Heart of the Matter, and on to a writer like J.M. Coetzee, when he has Elizabeth Costello talk about the suffering of animals. So one reason you might say I think there are several reasons for that being a recurring theme. One is that it is the central obstacle to religious belief. Personally speaking, it's the reason that I lost whatever faith I had as a teenager. but a secondary reason for that recurrence, the recurrence of questions of theodicy, might be that it takes writers back to a story, that it takes writers back to, or two stories, it takes writers back to Job, and it takes writers back to Adam and Eve. It takes them back to narrative and the question of what is what it means to put something in motion.
Thank you very much, James. Well, I hope that we're actually not well wadded with stupidity and that, in fact, we're full of interesting questions. Martin, did you want to say anything in response to what James has said before we start?
Perhaps pick up a bit on the problem of evil, because the problem of death is solved by sleight of hand, really. But the problem of evil doesn't go away. I'm just thinking of something that stuck in my mind from Graham Greene towards the end of Brighton Rock, when various, disgusting and hideous events have occurred. And Pinky's girlfriend, what is she called, is looking to the priest for comfort, and he says, "You cannot understand, my child, nor can anyone, the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God." Now, the degree of contortion within that rather beautiful statement seems to underpin all argument about theodicy, that the enormous artifice, this great body of knowledge and thought that has gone into explaining this one question, what is evil doing here on this planet, has always seemed to twist itself up to such an unimaginable contortion. And this is why, I think this is more than any kind of logical question. This is why the 10-year-old decides that this doesn't add up, that this can't be, that you can, a part of your mind, Saul Bellow, for instance, never gave up the idea that he would see his mother and his father and his brothers and his cousins when he died. And all he could say is that there's absolutely no rational justification for it. It all has to do with the strength of early affections. And he said, he never thought of God as moral in the sense that we think it, that we think of morality. As he says, I think very crushingly and resonantly in a few words, he says, it seemed to him very obvious early on that God was not impressed by death. God is not impressed by suffering. And only this gamble on the afterlife can make any sense of that. And so it all comes down to, how do you phrase it or rephrase it, James? That's going to wipe away our tears, this idea that it will be in the next life and not in this. And this doesn't make a moral God.
I'd certainly agree with that. Of course, depictions of heaven are it's a beautiful quotation, a beautiful poem by Herbert, was in some ways almost an instance, because it was almost a description both of mortal love and heavenly love. Descriptions of heaven as like descriptions of utopia are perhaps the most beautiful things, imaginings that literature can do. Dostoevsky was obsessed with the verses from John about God wiping away our the Book of Revelation, about wiping away our tears, and there will be no more pain and no more suffering, neither sorrow nor crying. The difficulty being, I think, for those inclined to thinking about theodicy, being, of course, that as Martin suggested, that heaven, the category of heaven, just creates a further difficulty for the explanation of why there is evil, because, of course, if there's a place elsewhere where suffering will be taken away from us, the mortal cry must be, why then and not now? There's a further philosophical problem, I think, about the category of heaven, at least traditionally thought of, which has to do with free will. And again, Dostoevsky proves an interesting writer as a responder to this. He has a little novella called The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, about a man who falls asleep and dreams that has a nightmare that he has died. And in the afterlife, or it seems the afterlife, he's been taken to a beautiful island, a Greek island, which is an Eden. it's a sort of Rousseauian natural place where nothing bad has happened. And then this man tells his first lie, and heaven becomes indeed like Eden at the beginning of the Bible, simply a place to be corrupted again by man. The point of the story being, I think, that that heaven needs to be a place without without free will, as we normally understand it, in order to remain heaven. If it's a place with free will, then obviously people will start messing it up, as they messed up Eden, or as they messed up the world. But if it's a place without free will, then it's not clear that we needed quite so much free will on Earth, the free will defense being the usual one in questions of theodicy. But that's something of a side issue. I'm interested in this question of death and Martin's suggestion that in some way religion solves the question of death or deals with the question of death sort of improperly almost, or not, you know, I know what you were saying, and that this can then be a great theme for literature to open up. And as you were talking, I was trying to think of sort of counterintuitively, I was trying to think of examples in secular literature, so examples in secular fiction of religious deaths, rather than secular deaths. I wasn't coming up with much. I mean, I suppose the obvious one would be the death of Ivan Illich in some way, though.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Yeah, Romeo and Juliet. Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
We see the sort of the semi-secular death in Dickens, where because he's a melodramatic writer and deals in the conventions of almost a music hall, he's not, I don't think, explicitly religious, except right. when he just can't bear it anymore. And when Esther Summerson in Bleak House dies, there's a suggestion of levitation and the soul making its journey. But when Little Nell dies, and Little Nell, this is an early novel, and Dickens not so in control of his material, when Little Nell dies, she quite candidly turns into an angel and sort of flaps up from her hovel. It always charmed me to read that there were riots on, you know, people used to wait in New York on the wharf for the next installment of the Dickens novel. And when the word got out that Little Nell was dead, there were fist fights and riots on the dockside. And Edgar Allan Poe, who was presumably at this point working on the murders in the Rue Morgue, was on a train when he finished when he finished the El Curiosity Shop, and dejectedly threw the book out of the window because he couldn't bear it. I think, you know, we all can't bear it. We all talk tough, but you know, someone said that the religious belief was essentially a failure of courage. But the inevitability of death does test us very deeply, and it weakens us to such an extent that we grasp for this sort of fait accompli of the afterlife.
I think the same thing that happened to Dickens happened to an episode of The Archers. At this point, what I'd like to do is to open it up to the floor. Now, the convention will be that there are two people on either side with radio mics, and so if you can put your hand up, then a radio mic will be given to you. There are lots of themes here on the table: literature and evil, literature and death, literature and heaven, whether literature replaces religion in some form, religion belief, the transmutation of doctrine when you actually have got someone like Graham Greene writing from a certain kind of Catholic perspective as a novelist, all sorts of ideas already. The theme is vast, so who wants to go first? There's a person over here. The man over there. Yeah, thank you.
Norman Herringshaw. I think I'm an evangelical. I'm born again, charismatic for a time in Pentecostal movement. I have found that through my faith, my interest in the arts in general, in literature, music, in paintings, has deepened rather than that I've resisted and resented the effects of that experience in myself. Recently, there's been a lot of criticism of the position of what are called fundamentalists in the press. Karen Armstrong calls me mistaken. Philip Pullman calls my faith poisonous. Ian McEwan calls it a fantasy. I would like to write a good book, something on the lines of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Because of all this pressure on me, as someone who is seen as somewhat unbalanced, do you think I should pursue my goal?
Can I be clear then that the question is, should you continue to actually pursue the goal of being a novelist?
A novelist
despite your beliefs?
Because of my beliefs.
All right. Okay. It's like a talent show, really, isn't it?
I would ask for counsel from your higher father. I think that's your best bet. But good luck.
It sounds to me as if you should write allegory. And in some way, the writers that you mentioned, particularly Lewis, did essentially write allegory and had a great interest in allegory as medievalists. Graham Greene's come up a few times. I think, in a way, nothing better shows that the contemporary novel, the modern novel, is a secular form than the problems he gets into. I mean, Martin was suggesting this as a religious novelist. In, say, a novel like The End of the Affair, where he brings in three or four miracles at the end, and he knows that actually he shouldn't be doing this. So he tries to fudge it by talking about them as, you know, as sort of coincidences, and the sort of question of the novel is, you know, when do four coincidences equal a miracle? But I think he knew as a novelist that it's a profoundly awkward way to finish that book. Which up until then had been an interesting exploration of the tension between faith and unbelief. So perhaps an allegory would be the right way to go.
Although it would be interesting that both when Philip Pullman's Dark Trilogies was actually filmed, they actually emphasised the religious element of it. It wasn't anti-clerical. Ian McEwan's still plays with religious ideas irrespective of whether he believes in them. And the lady at the front here.
I wrote several questions before I came, and none of them at the moment do I want to ask you about, because I'm amazed that the gentleman behind me said something similar to what I was feeling. For me, my faith in Christianity was crushed when Don Cupid, the theologian, literally hammered it for me in Sea of Faith, because that was exactly how I was feeling about Christianity myself. I was continually questioning and saying, I too feel the points that you are raising. And what I found most amazing is that I went on a journey of total unbelief, and yet I needed something to believe in. And after about 10 years, I found something amazing did happen. The novel that the gentleman said he might want to write fell on my head. And I wrote a novel, which is yet unpublished, where people like you are sitting talking to people like me, asking if it is possible that there is a place where everybody feels that the world in which they're living does not exist. Is there such a place as a fallen race or a fallen world? And they call that course of study the belief in the consequences of original sin and the polarisation of the world. Is it possible, gentlemen, that any of you could actually envisage a world where, from our position, it would look like perfection And yet to them, it's quite normal. And they don't see it as perfection until someone tells them that there are people like us at another end of the universe discussing if people like them exist.
Thank you.
Have I lost you, or do you understand me?
All right.
No, I understand you perfectly.
Do you want to start?
Well, yeah. Let's talk perhaps for a little bit about utopia. And, you know, there are certain thinkers like John Gray, for example, brilliant John Gray, author of Straw Dogs and Black Mass, who says that, you know, we're helplessly enthralled to religious and Christian notions. All our attempts to create not just perfect societies, but, you know, incrementally improve societies would not occur to anyone who hadn't been raised in with the background of Christian deliverance and all the other ideas that come with it. My objection to the utopia as a realizable idea is not so much for the usual reasons that you can't have it and violence is almost mandated to bring it about. And if we want to talk about the durability and the unsuppressibility of the religious impulse, the regime that tried hardest, I think, in the history of the world to get rid of religion was the Bolshevik regime. And to the tune of 15,000 clerics killed by Lenin in, I think, around 1922, including 5,000 nuns. So, you know, killing the clerics, I don't think has ever been, there's been great anti-clerical riots and so on, but as systematically attempted as that. And, you know, Russia, of course, remains and remained throughout this period one of the most religious societies on earth. When people talk about getting rid of religion, you should snigger because, you know, as neuroscience is showing us, it is there's not a gene for God, but it is just too integrally human. We are yearning, believing creatures. But the utopia and the idea of heaven is not the least bit attractive to me. My father was a communist until 1956, and I never really had this argument with him. But I wanted to say, you know, what on earth would you do in this utopia? It's a repellent idea that people are shuffling around beaming at each other, helping each other out, and it's some terrible yokel scene from a medieval fantasy. Where would the art be in the utopia? I mean, you know, the art, it couldn't sustain art of any kind, a utopia. So, you know, it disqualifies itself, and the same can be said for heaven. Although I have to say, controversially perhaps, that the Islamic heaven does have a certain appeal. That is utterly absent from the Christian and the Judaic, etc., etc.
James, just one or two things. I would look to somewhere like Paradiso, which is the third part of Dante's Divine Commedia, who does try and give a portrayal of that kind of world that's very remote from and yet looks down through the various kinds of other purgatory and hell to understand everything from the condition of love, which is the final image at the end of the poem. And the other one I was thinking about when you were talking was a French writer called Charles Péguy, who at the end of his poem called The Portal of Hope talks about God's not surprised when he looks down on the world about despair, and he's not surprised that he sees betrayal, and he's not surprised that he sees disappointment. What surprises God most of all is that he sees human hope. So, Can we take the one from this side? Thank you. And then there's somebody at the back afterwards.
I'm the desolate woman described in Isaiah 54. And I just wanted to say that I think it was Blake who said, joy and woe are intertwined, a clothing for the life divine. And if these two we truly know, safely through this world we go. And it's been my experience that suffering can turn you out or it can turn you in. And some people turn in and some people turn out.
Can I take the one? Yes, the middle, person in the middle, man in the middle. Right in the middle, yeah.
Hi, my name's Steve. In your introduction, you talked about a revival of religion, post-secularism, and you talked about the notion of that. I mean, I sort of dispute that, which I'd like to hear more from the two of you about your ideas on how that is going. Whilst I recognise that religion has brought a lot to the table in the world of literature, especially in the early days. Possibly it was a very good midwife and then became a very bad parent. And perhaps secularism is a more liberating atmosphere, and it has been a progressive movement, whereas religion, the atmosphere of that is more constricting and restricts freedom, really. So you have a writer like Dickens, who is a bit of a mixed bag, and he can be a bit over-sentimental. And in the scene you were talking about Little Nell, he can be very flawed when he starts switching on to religion. So that's a good example of how I see religion being constricting. And in fact, it was Oscar Wilde had a good quote about that, which I can't quite remember, which was, anybody who reads The Death of Little Nell and doesn't cry, a man has a heart of stone if he reads The Death of Little Nell and doesn't cry of laughter. So
that's Oscar Wilde, yeah.
I'd like you to talk more about how if you really do see a revival of religion, and I mean, I'm perhaps thinking, I don't see that as the case. I see perhaps that as just the final bounce of a body that's fallen out of a window, really. So we'll leave that to you.
Okay, thanks. I mean, this isn't really to do with me, it's to do with these two. But so all I would say is this is what sociologists are actually talking about at the moment, but maybe... Is literature becoming less secular, if I put that question to both of you?
Well, I mean, I'd actually be interested to hear from you, Graham, what you think about the revival of religion and/or the death of secularism or implosion of secularism. I think I'd take issue a little bit. I mean, I'm not a believer, and I've had real battles over the years with believers. In some ways, I'm forever marked by that. But I think I'd take issue a little bit with the sort of binarism that was set up in that question: secularism, progressive, liberating; religion, constricting. I mean, one of the weakest things done in the Dawkins, Harris, and even to some extent Hitchens books about religion, to my mind at least, is their emphasis on fallible religious practice. That's to say, religious wars, nasty paedophile priests, and the rest of it. Seems to me, if you really want to dismantle the foundations of belief, then you have to go back to the foundations of belief and start with something like the problem of evil, and at least have a proper theological fight. And I think the reason that that talking about fallible Christian or religious practice is a bit of a mistake, I think it's the obvious reason that there's certainly been as much good religious practice as there has been fallible religious practice. And all around the world, right now, we can find very ennobling instances in which the church, or using that as a figure of speech, the church is actually the repository of what's most progressive. I mean, whether it's somewhere like Zimbabwe,
or even sometimes in this country. So I don't like the premises of that question. However, I do think that literature, as I said earlier, is an essentially secular form. So the interesting thing for the contemporary novel will be how does it talk about, as you rightly put it, the sort of dying moans of a Christian tradition, right? And we are talking about the dying moans of a Christian tradition. I mean, it would be absurd to talk about Islam in a similar way. But how do we talk about the long withdrawing roar, the sea of faith, in an interesting way, and at the same time as a novelist, because I think this is what the novel has to do, also talk about what Graham mentioned as the revival of religion. That's to say, how would you, on the one hand, set a novel in contemporary Britain, in which you talked about, in which you evoked a general feebleness, a sort of echo of religious practice, and say at the same time described a fervent Muslim who believed none of that, who simply thought that such talk about the dying embers of religion was complete rubbish. How would you talk about the fierceness of submission involved in that kind of religious practice? I don't think we've yet had a novelist who's done something like that, though we can think of people who've put their toes into the water and tried. But when they've tried to do it wholeheartedly, let's say like John Updike in his novel Terrorist, it's been a disaster.
Yes, to mention these huge best-selling books that have attacked religion, Dawkins and Hitchens. I mean, Christopher Hitchens is my oldest friend, and nothing he does is can I disapprove of. But I've been at public debates where, when he's talking to religious people who've stood up and said, "But I happen to believe this," he said, "So that's all right, you know, just do it in your room, you know." I don't mind if you do it in your room. And it's certainly true, is it not, that that communalizing, it's when human beings get together that they're dangerous. And perhaps I should have said earlier that the great difference, the great divergence between literature and religion, and why literature can never be a religion, is because all its voices are individual, irreducibly or unexpandably individual. And despite the efforts of American book clubs and coffee afternoons and all that, it's a deeply personal, private, lone experience. But I think the battle, the Dawkins-Hitchens battle, is over, really, and it was really a battle against scripture, and at least in as far as Christianity is concerned, the authenticity of scripture, its binding moral edicts, are now very seriously doubted. And the argument has moved on, not so much with Judaism and Islam, perhaps, but and now it's in neuroscience, and Graham knows all about this, the propensity for belief. And it's surely right, I think, to, as John Gray says, that what kind of humanist hates this human quality of wanting to believe, of yearning, of wanting the problem of evil to be, to have their tears wiped away? How can you be a good humanist and sneer at that? The most damning thing ever written about religion, I think, is by Conrad. It's in the introduction to his short novel, The Shadow Line, I think 1918, written as his, 1916, written as his son Boris entered the First World War. Conrad was too old, and the passage goes something like, it's not fiction, I'm far too intoxicated by the natural to be tempted by the merely supernatural. This enchantment with things as they actually are almost renders life to be a state of intoxication. And religion, as it has always been, take it any way you like, is a tawdry, man-made fantasy that is an insult, an outrage upon our dignity. And he said, "This is the sort of crux of it." He says, "I will never, my imagination will never seek sustenance from this tawdry construct, and our readiness to believe in it, which in itself is enough to reduce all lovers of humanity to unutterable sadness." Now, that's as fierce a denunciation of religious belief as I've ever seen. And I think, actually, that once religion is no longer a spur to action, it's no longer a part of government, then I don't think it fills us with sadness anymore. And I think that we accept it and include it and embrace it as something that very many of us want to do.
Several questions. We've only got a couple of minutes to go. Can I take the lady back there? Yeah, if you want to stand up, then they will be able to give you the mic.
This really follows on from what Martin Amos was saying about people together. And I've had a feeling throughout tonight that the panel's thoughts on religion are somewhat outdated, I'm sorry to say. My feeling is that postmodern Christianity and the way things are being looked at in the theological side is looking much more at something for the future which is going to be individualistic. It is going to be something that people will follow perhaps on their own. And a lot of the things that people have been writing about in novels and in literature under the guise of religion are actually cultural things. They are societal things. We all went to church, we all wore bonnets, we're all Dickensian. Well, we're not, and we don't. And so I'm wondering if the panel could give us any ideas of anyone who is writing about a spirituality for the future, about a new way of relating to the divine.
First of all, I don't actually agree with your characterization of literature's interest in religion. It's true that when we look at the novel, one of the forms, as Martin suggested, one of the most popular forms is anti-clericalism. So we get again and again, at least in the Western tradition, descriptions of being in church, and we get descriptions of the foolish or venal priest, from Father Collins to Mr. Collins to the awful sermonizer in The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man who terrorizes the poor children with his idea of the infinity of heaven being like, you know, the tiny grain of sand. Being a tiny grain of sand. But actually, I'm struck by how fiercely the novel and poetry engages with religious questions, not at that. There is, you know, you can go to a writer like Flaubert, say, with his absurd descriptions of Monsieur Homais on the one side, you know, the ridiculous pharmacist, and on the other side of the village, the absurd, equally superstitious priest. And you can come away from a book like Madame Bovary feeling that in some way he's left everything exactly as it was, because the critique wasn't fundamental enough. However, and I think that's what you're talking about, however, if you go to someone like Dostoevsky, who was a believing Christian but perhaps the greatest doubter, or a writer like George Eliot, in Middlemarch, or a writer, an atheist like Thomas Hardy, you get the most fundamental critiques of not just religious practice, not communal practice, but an engagement with doctrinal issues having to do with the salvation of the soul. So I'm not sure I agree with that. However, that's perhaps I'm just being pedantic. One of the interesting things about contemporary American fiction, unlike, I think, contemporary British fiction, is that I can think of three or four major writers who are actually believers. And they are John Updike, Marilyn Robinson, who's a strict Protestant, and Cormac McCarthy, who by all accounts has had an evangelical conversion. The strains of which, I would say, you can feel at the end of his novel, The Road. I'm not sure I would recommend The Road as pointing to any future, since what it points to is the end of everything. But up until that last turning of the theological screw, where we're given a little going-home present at the end of the book, up until that moment, it seems to me a devastating an evocation of our ultimate annihilation. And reading it, it made me think, is there any, perhaps Graham can answer this question, is there any movement in contemporary theology that is responding to climate change, that's to say, is responding to the possibility of our, if not our ultimate annihilation, then certainly to the likely degradation of life as we know it. What are theologians saying about this? What are they saying? How are they reading its implications for God's providential control of the world? I don't think it's enough simply to say, aha, well, it's all up to us to, you know, do our recycling properly. It should raise, and McCarthy's aware of this, the profoundest theological implications. If the world's going to wither away in 100 years' time, then it would seem that we're all whistling in the dark.
In fact, theologians have been doing that, but what they battle against is something you're pointing to at the moment, which is, in fact, a very popular genre and return of the apocalyptic. And in Cormac McCarthy would be a very good kind of place to start. And what they're also battling with is the cheap way in which I think Cormac McCarthy puts the end of that, where you've got some kind of messianic return. Mm. Martin? we have finished the time. I just wondered whether you had any last comments to say about
no,
new spirituality in contemporary novels. Harry Potter, for instance.
No, I think I would lean. Of course, theology and spirituality, as is defined by theology, will continue. But I think I must close by saying that I'm more of the Conrad party in this respect. He says that having solved the problem of death, that what this does is cheapen and despiritualize our relationship with the living and the dead in their countless multitudes. I think it's to free yourself of all doctrine and all these pseudo-solutions to crushing psychological problems is an evasion, and actually greater spirituality in a way is asked of the secular who do not gird themselves with these structures, that it's actually a spiritual choice. It's very hard, and that's why so many of us can't do it. But to face up to death, to face up to what this does to the memory of your dead and to your living and what is going to happen to them and what's going to happen to you is a spiritual journey.
That's perhaps why Mother Teresa's last letters are so profound in many ways. We've come to the end of this event. And I just want us, first of all, to thank our speakers and to thank you. But let's thank of our speakers first. I wanted to thank you for coming and just alert you to two events, well, three events, actually, which are there to be had in the future. On the 23rd of July, we've got Ian Maguire and Michael Simmons-Roberts, and then Martin's back talking in the autumn about Philip Larkin and literature and science. Now, I've been asked to say, could you all remain here while the three of us depart, because these two have got some book signings to do. So if you remain here while Joe takes us away, and then someone will give some indication about when we've disappeared enough for you to actually be able to leave. Thank you very much.